All right, good morning, everyone. So I had the pleasure this morning of speaking to you about supporting global critical care in resource variable settings through medical education. If you know, most of the talks I give have very long titles like this. My name is Bert Lee, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about my background and story first, and then we'll get into the aspects of critical care and medical education. So let me just tell you a little bit of my backstory very briefly. After fellowship, my first main job was at MedStar Washington Hospital Center, and I was on faculty at Georgetown University. At about the level of associate professor, I had a chance to go on a sabbatical. And this is where my global critical care experience really begins. So when I was in D.C., I had a whole variety of roles teaching various courses and classes, and I was a program director for the fellowship program and ran some clinical rotations as well as a bunch of classrooms as well. But then 1 year I had the opportunity to have a sabbatical. And the sabbatical ended up being a nice experience for us to say, well, you know what, it's 1 year, and our whole family was able to move with me. And then I think most of you know that 1 year is a long time, but it's also a very, very short time in the global health setting because it's very difficult to do anything meaningful in 1 year. So I quickly realized that 1 year was insufficient, so that 1 year turned into 6 years. And then fortunately, my family was thriving, and they really loved what they were doing. My wife and I took the family at a time when they usually say you shouldn't do it, which was at the ages of 12 and 15. So they're teenagers, they're in the middle of school, and at least one's in high school, and they got to think about all the things that happens in that age group. But we did it anyway, initially because it was thought to be 1 year, but they really, really loved the experience. And actually, at the end of 1 year, we kind of had a democratic process where we're trying to vote, are we going to stay, are we going to not? And actually, our kids said, Dad, if you want to go back, you can, but we're not going back. So I was like, okay. So it looks like I've been outvoted either way. So we ended up staying there. This was the hospital where I did my medical work. Like I said, we were there for about 6 years, and I think probably most of you have heard of this hospital and may have actually worked there. And then when our kids graduated, the younger of the two actually graduated from high school at Rift Valley Academy. Then I had two kids in college, and at that point, I kind of needed a quote-unquote a real job to pay for two kids in college, and then we moved back to the U.S. to help with that. And then the job that I got when I came back from the mission field was at University of Pittsburgh, where I was on faculty there, and right now I'm actually at the National Institutes of Health, where I'm the head of medical education and the head of global critical care. I think I was just explaining to someone earlier, but I think the government doesn't allow you to say I work for the government, so that's why it's not on my title slide. But I do work for the federal government. So my career, as you can see, has involved a lot of medical education, both in the U.S. As well as in sub-Saharan Africa. And quite honestly, I have absolutely loved what I do. So I've said this before many times, but honestly, if I didn't get paid for what I'm doing, I would probably still do what I do. I really, really love it. And I would always ask that you don't tell my boss that, because then he might actually take me up on it, because I do want to get paid, but I would still do it even if I didn't. So I do really love what I do. So I think it's a great privilege for me to be in this position of I get to do what I love to do, and I get to educate people, I get to do academic endeavors, but both in the U.S. and in sub-Saharan Africa. So you might think, well, why medical education? Well, you know, I think medical education for me is personally very fulfilling, but I think, you know, all of you know this, but the needs are also compelling for medical education. So this is a paper from the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2014. I think many of you have probably have seen this, but this is simply on the x-axis is the number of doctors, nurses, midwives, so basically healthcare providers on the x-axis, and on the y-axis is the daily adjusted life years per 1,000 people. Okay, and this is in terms of actually the disease burden, I should say. So if you look, sub-Saharan Africa is at the very top of the all the you know all the suffering and loss of lives and loss of productivity. And on the other hand, if you look at America and Europe, the supply of physicians, nurses, and midwives are really high. And then the relative size of those circles represents the percent supply in the world of healthcare providers. So in other words, sub-Saharan Africa has only 3% of the world supply, but the highest disease burden. So it doesn't take a mathematician to kind of look at that and saying, wow, you know, there is a tremendous opportunity and a need there. So that's part of the reason why I chose to go there for my sabbatical year. And then some, you know, a little more concrete numbers. I think, you know, everybody knows this kind of stuff, of course, but in the U.S. it's about 549 doctors per 100,000 people. And in most of sub-Saharan Africa, as you can see, the numbers are in the single digits of 2 to 5 people. So a tremendous disparities. I like this map because this kind of gives you the world map in a more of a graphical form here. I think you know that this is basically supply of healthcare providers, and it's showing the world map in that way. And basically, as you can see, much of North America, Europe, and some parts of Asia are extremely obese. It's very overloaded with healthcare providers. And then much of the Southern Hemisphere, including Sub-Saharan Africa, is incredibly emaciated. So one potential implication for you, I know there are a lot of young people here, you know, who I'm speaking to, is that, you know, you may want to consider a career in medical education because the needs are obvious, the opportunities are great, and you can make a great impact around the world being in medical education. So I'm an intensivist, so I specialize in people who are critically ill, and a lot of what I do is very expensive, unfortunately. So some people argue, well, you know, why do that when you should be vaccinating kids and, you know, improving nutrition and stuff like that? So people argue for public health, and others argue, you know, you should do primary care rather than tertiary care and things like that. And I would never argue with any of those arguments. I think those are very, very valid. But it's never really one or the other, right? Because if you have somebody who's critically ill, then they are, they're literally dying in front of you. And they're often, they don't necessarily need expensive care, but they need high quality care. It doesn't have to be expensive. So here's a study actually by the World Bank that says that about 45% of the death and 36% of the disabilities around the world could be prevented if you actually had better emergency and critical care. So these are kind of things that I think most of you know, but in the country of Kenya, approximately 53 million people, they had 150 ICU beds in the entire country. In the U.S., there's about 320 million people, and there are 94,000 ICU beds. I think when I went, I was one of the very few people who were actually trained in critical care medicine. By 2020, when I looked it up in the time for the pandemic, because I was really afraid about what might happen, there were 12 critical care physicians in the country of Kenya right before the pandemic. So not many people in there. In contrast, when I came back from Kenya and took my faculty position at University of Pittsburgh, at one hospital, which is the Presbyterian Hospital in Pittsburgh, there were 150 ICU beds in that one building, and there were 186 faculty So you know, oftentimes my colleagues would ask me, you know, what were you doing in Kenya, and why were you there? And among other things, I could just simply say, you know, there's 186 of you here in one building, and the distribution of physicians is obviously not the same. So the other potential implication for you is that I think I would say maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago, if you want to consider a career in global health or in medical missions, I think the obvious thing is you want to probably pursue things like general surgery and family medicine and things of that nature, because you want to be broadly useful to the people that you'll be serving. But what I would say today is that's still true. There are many, many needs like that, so I would still encourage you to consider the exact same field. But I think some of you actually have a passion for something different. You know, some of you might be more passionate about neurology or about about pediatric oncology and things that are more subspecialty based sometimes. But I think the needs, even in the subspecialties, are tremendous. And actually, some of the closed doors around the world are open to people with actually specialty skills now. So I would encourage you that if you are interested in something else, maybe it's something that God has placed in your heart for a reason. So now we started a training program in my 6 years there, and I think I mentioned that you know, 1 year is a long time, but it's very short, and that's because, you know, when I went there, I went with a typical American mindset. Okay, I know what to do. I've done something like this before, and I just need to shake the, you know, like the right hands, and I have a draft plan, and I got all these emails set up, and I have, you know, my 1 year vision, and this is pretty easy. Of course, that's completely wrong. I knew absolutely nothing about what I was talking about. And it took a lot of conversation over chai. I mean, I think I went to the bathroom often because of all the chai that I drank, just to have the time to figure out which end was really up. And it was quite humbling to realize that I really didn't know what I was talking about. And as you probably know, you know, a lot of things in this part of the world, it doesn't happen because of a contract or because of an email. It actually happens because you're building relationships and you're having conversation and you're having just face-to-face discussions. And so things are slower. It doesn't move according to the American clock, basically. And so when we were there, you know, I realized that, you know, I still had a limited number of years, about 6 years or so, to get this accomplished, because I knew that my daughter was going to graduate from high school there, and so forth. And so within that time plan, we thought about, okay, how can we make an impact in this country, and in this region in particular? And so we went after a group of people called clinical officers. So what are clinical officers? I think the closest thing in the U.S. are physician assistants. So they're not physicians, they're not nurses, they're not nurse practitioners, but they're you know, highly skilled people. They didn't go to medical school, but they have substantial clinical skills. Now, some of these people are actually incredibly bright. I think if they were in the U.S. and had the same opportunity, you know, they would have gone to the best medical schools in the U.S., but they just didn't have the means to do that. And so some of them were looking for, you know, I think for a greater opportunity. So we decided to concentrate on clinical officers. Now, just to show you, there are other efforts, obviously, in sub-Saharan Africa. So probably the best example of the efforts in sub-Saharan Africa is this. It's this group called EATI, for East African Training Initiative. This is actually a collaboration from several academic institutions in the U.S. And with Ethiopia. So they have actually a fellowship program there. But they're aiming doctors. And so they train, I think, one or two people a year, which is wonderful, and I applaud that. But we wanted to train more people than that. And also we felt that, you know, doctors are in short supply, and some of them, you know, need to be surgeons, and some of them need to be anesthesiologists, and we weren't sure that we wanted to, like, take everybody who's so scarce and valuable, so we decided to go after clinical officers. So at Kajabi Hospital, we did that because the ratio of clinical officers to physicians was 4-1, so it made sense to try to educate the people who are in relative abundance. So we created a program called the Emergency Critical Care Clinical Officer Program, or ECHO. Okay, you have to have a nice name, so and a nice acronym. So that's what we came up with is the ECHO program. We started it at the tail end of my time in Kenya, and actually we were able to publish that in the African Journal of Emergency Medicine. So it's a 2-year training program. And all of the curriculum is on Google Drive because Google Drive is free, and free is nice for this setting. And so here's an example of some of the ICU curriculum. There's a separate curriculum for the emergency medicine. And if you open it up, there is, there's reading assignments. There are questions for them to answer. And I could tell you more details about the curriculum, but it goes through sepsis, mechanical ventilation, and many procedural things as well. So a lot of my work involved not only that, but also like fundraising. And so there's obvious fundraising things for tuition and things of that nature. But one of the biggest hurdles in this part of the world is actually that little dish over there, which is for internet. So actually having a small grant for actually providing relatively high-speed internet allowed you to do this, which is we invite people to our living rooms, and they're actually able to take classes there and to use Wi-Fi to look up the literature and to access the Google Drive and things like that. And then part of the vision for us is not just doing medical training, which of course is one of the core missions, but we also wanted to have our ECHO officers have a vision for the rest of Africa. And so this is one of our ECHO officers on a short-term trip with us to a neighboring country. And I think one of the things that she said to us was remarkable is that she says, until this program, and then until she went on this trip, she never thought of herself as someone who could be a blessing to other people in this way. Because for her, she says, hey, you know what, all the missionaries are white, not in my case, but in most cases, they're white, and they never thought of themselves as being somebody who could be in that role. And so to me, it was very encouraging to see a transformation in their attitude and then realizing that, that the next generation of people who are going to do this work, it should be everybody, and it should be the Africans who are leading that. So of course, when we planned this, we had no idea that the pandemic was going to hit. But it turned out that by the time the pandemic hit, we had scores of ECHO officers trained, and actually they were the front lines in Kenya that the vast majority of the critically ill people in the emergency rooms and ICUs in Kenya were actually cared for by our ECHO officers. So some of the milestones of the ECHO program, this is actually us celebrating our first graduating class on a whitewater rafting trip. But we actually won formal approval in 2017, which is 2 years after we started. And for those of you who may have spent time in sub-Saharan Africa or in the U.S. government, by the way, any kind of approval is really slow. And so we were like shocked when they approved it right away. And now our ECHO officers are all over the country. And now we train about 12 people per year. And then one of our graduates has started a new training program in Nairobi at the Kenya Medical Training College, and they train now 14 people per year. And because of the success of the adult version of the ECHO program, now there's a pediatric program. I think they call it PICO program in 2020. And we expect to have graduated 250 ECHO officers by the year 2030. So not a solution to the shortage of the clinicians who can do this, but I think a substantial progress compared to where we started. So this is the picture of our graduating class in 2016. This is one of the graduates named Samuel. And actually, every one of the first years, they all have taken on either faculty positions or leadership positions. And so now much of the work is actually done without physician, direct intervention. So there's still physician, oversight of the program, but it's really done by the ECHO officers. So here is a ECHO conference in 2022. These are all the graduates that have occurred. And then here's same Samuel, who's now on faculty, teaching. So it was really just a very emotional moment for me to see this. So what are we doing now? So we are hoping to support global critical care efforts still, and so we're doing this in a through a new effort. So it's called the Global Critical Care Collaborations. So our goal is to collaboratively partner with clinicians in low-resource countries for capacity building, both clinically and in terms of research. So we have these eight academic institutions. One of them is Aga Khan University in Nairobi, and for those of you who might not know, Aga Khan is actually one of their premier university hospitals in Nairobi. They have incredibly intelligent, doctors and nurses, and they have an excellent training program, and they do research and things like that. So it's actually a high-resource institution, and the rest are in the U.S. And we have partnerships, with like Beth Israel at Harvard and Baylor College of Medicine, NIH, Mayo Clinic, University of Alabama, and Pittsburgh and Arizona and so forth. And we have critical care physicians who, most of whom have lived in the African continent for 1 year or longer. And they're all believers, but we're all working in secular institutions. And we're partnering to all help out at Kajabi Hospital. To continue the support of what is happening there. So we have both African and missionary members at Kajabi. So what is our goal? So our goal includes doing patient care, but also clinician capacity building through education and also research capacity building. So all of these eight institutions, we're committed as faculty now to go back to Kajabi at least once a year, but hopefully 2 or 3 times a year. So each faculty is committed to doing that. But we're also bringing fellows from our institutions. And our goal now is to provide approximately 6 months of coverage by an intensivist. Because right now they don't have an intensivist on staff there. They have internists who do a great job, but we'll be providing some further clinical support. And then we'll also be doing clinician capacity building. Obviously we'll be there to actually provide bedside teaching and some routine lectures, but we're also going to be putting on courses on let's say on ultrasound, mechanical ventilation. And even research methodology classes and biostatistics courses. And then the part that we're excited about is for research capacity building. What we have noticed is that there are tr you know there's a tremendous enthusiasm for research at Kajabi with incredibly talented people, but they don't have necessarily the mentorship in many cases, but also there's no protected time. It's not like a system in the U.S. where if you're in academics, you have a certain number of weeks protected by either research grants or by some other mechanism. And so they're incredibly talented, ambitious, hardworking people, but they just don't have time to do this kind of stuff. And so we're trying to provide that time. And so how do we provide that time is when our fellows go, they're going to go for a month at a time, and they'll be relieving the African nationals so that when we go, they have the time protected for academic research. And then all the research is going to be done in partnership with them. And then we'll be helping them along. So we already have several projects. I think one is by Beth Riviello from Beth Israel. We're doing a randomized control trial called the BREATHE trial. And then we have actually built the database of like traumatic brain injury patients who we're starting to write papers in partnership. So you might think, well, like research capacity building might not, seem like medical missions per se. But if you look at this data, this is a study in public health in 2003. This is where they report what percentage of the world literature comes out of different regions of the world. And the percent that comes out of sub-Saharan Africa is less than 1%. And the problem is, a lot of the data that we generate in the U.S., of course, is applicable to other parts of the world, but a lot of it is also not. Okay? And so if you really want to provide better care in sub-Saharan Africa, we need Africans to produce African data that's relevant to Africa. And so this is part of our great mission, is to try to foster that environment and to create that ethos, and then give them practical tools, and to do it together in partnership. So we have finished our phase one of this project, which is from year 2021 to 2023. All of the faculty members that was listed in the earlier page have gone, have shaken hands, have drunk a lot of chai together, and have formed relationships, and everybody knows each other. And now we just launched phase two as of this academic year. So we sent our first fellow from University of Pittsburgh, and then others will be going from National Institutes of Health this spring to provide that 6 months of coverage. And then at some point, we hope to expand to other sites besides Kajabi. We had several requests from other institutions asking for similar kind of support. But we decided that instead of, having one academic institution partner with one hospital, and then having another institution partner with another hospital, we're actually deliberately doing this in a somewhat conservative fashion. Because at least in my experience, many people come with bright ideas and a lot of enthusiasm, and they seem to fade after a year or two for a variety of reasons. Some because they lose enthusiasm, other times they run out of money, other times there's a sickness in the family. Something always seems to happen. So we're actually starting deliberately together on one in one institution, so that if two of us, something happens to two of us, there's still more left over. And we also have plenty of other institutions who want to join us now because they're excited about this. But we're saying, hold off. We're going to start with the people that we started off, and then we hope to learn together, make mistakes together, and then hopefully revise our approach carefully. So I think this is a topic that's probably near and dear to Dr. Schlosser's heart here. But I just want to give you an example of why you might want to think about the research aspects of global health and missions. So here's a paper by Manny Rivers in the New England Journal of Medicine 2001. I think some of the older people might know this study very well. This is a study, it was done among U.S. adults. And the bottom line conclusion, because this is not a clinical topic, so I won't go into all the gory details, but the bottom line conclusion was that we should resuscitate people aggressively if you are sick with sepsis. Okay? Well, then comes a study among kids in sub-Saharan Africa, actually in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. Much better study, much larger study. And they actually found that if you resuscitate people too quickly by giving boluses, there's a higher mortality. Okay? And so when you're seeing this kind of data, even though the first paper was a small study, poor methodology quality, with a huge commercial bias, okay, but because it was done by an American professor in the U.S., the bias is the African trial must be wrong. Right? But like I said, if you look at the quality, again, I'm not going to go through the details here, but it's a pretty poor study. But the other one was much better study, much larger number of patients, multi-center study with very thoughtful people doing the trial. Well, there are several then studies in adults to see, well, which is true. And this is one of the three major trials, again, done in U.S. adults. And again, a very high-quality trial. And they show no difference in mortality. And then here's another study in JAMA in sub-Saharan Africa among Zambian adults. And again, not as good as some of the other studies, but still better than the original Rivers paper. And they found, again, higher mortality with aggressive resuscitation. Okay. So I think this kind of data really highlights why we need to do research in Africa for Africa. Okay? Because you can't necessarily just plop something that we think is right in the US and just apply it there, because potentially it could be increased mortality. Okay? But we're not going to know that unless we are actually doing research in the relevant setting. So the other implication for you is that I know that many of you who are interested in global health and medical missions, you're thinking mostly clinically, okay, about you want to be a good doctor, and you should, of course, okay? But you may be neglecting an area or a skill that you may not have thought about before. One of them is medical education, but the other might be research. So remember that biostats class that you absolutely hated? Okay? You may want to pick up that book again, okay? Because it may be more relevant to God's kingdom than you realize. Okay? All right. So some final words of caution, and I'd love to open it up because I know there's lots of people with a lot more experience than me and a lot of wisdom here. But a very important caution is, I wonder if you all know who this person is. So this is Jomo Kenyatta, who was the first president of Kenya. And he actually has a very haunting quote that, in my opinion, I think everybody who's interested in global health or medical missions should know what he said. Okay? And to me, it should be the page two of every missions conference. What did he say? He says, "When the missionaries arrived, the Africans had the land and the missionaries had the Bible. They taught us how to pray with our eyes closed. When we opened them, they had the land and we had the Bible." Okay? It's a pretty sobering, scathing comment. Okay? But I think there's a little bit of truth in this, right? Is that sometimes in our best efforts to do medical missions or global health, sometimes we do it in a way that is not honoring to God and is not loving to the people, and ultimately our message gets ruined. And so I think we need to do this very carefully with a lot of caution. So here's a paper, from, basically, secular journals, talking about the impact of global health in various groups of people. So here is the high-income country participant or institution. That would be you, or that would be your hospital or university. They document that there is a greater knowledge and skill by the person who goes and does these kind of trips. And they learn about cost-effective care because now you practice, or you witness some practice in, let's say, in sub-Saharan Africa, and you come back with a greater appreciation for what makes sense economically and what doesn't. They learn about social determinants of health, that it's not just, person A with a disease Y, but there is, issues of poverty and malnutrition and even legal injustices that contribute to healthcare. And you learn about cultural sensitivity and competence. And then many studies show that actually if you go on these kind of trips and you serve in this capacity, many of them actually develop an interest and compassion for domestic service, so these are all great things. But what they conclude, I'm sorry, and then for the institution, they like it because they can put that on this on their webpage and say, "We are these, we're whatever university or this hospital," and it gives them a better image or brand. And also nowadays, because so many people, both Christian and non-Christian, are interested in global health, it helps them boost recruitment into their residencies and even faculty level. So there's a lot of potential benefits for institutions and individuals. But they warn that in terms of the benefit to the host institution, that is, let's say, a Kajabi hospital or the patients there, the benefit is actually questionable, like in terms of actual data. Okay? And so we got to be very careful that we're not taking advantage of these kind of situations where we're going for that Instagram picture or to feel good about ourselves that we're good people doing this. And we have to remember, what are we actually doing for the host institutions and the patients. And here's a systematic review of the different global health electives, and they worry in this study about physicians practicing outside of competence. So this would be someone like me delivering babies, perhaps. Okay? And they also talk about draining resources because you go there, you don't speak the language, you don't know the system, so then everybody has to cater to you while you're working there. And then, of course, these are, almost unavoidable, but like cultural insensitivity mistakes. Some worry about the perpetuation of neocolonialism and white saviorism and racism. And then they worry about power imbalances because we're coming with the knowledge and the money and all that stuff. And then perhaps creating unintended dependencies. And then we want to be careful that we don't replace national. So, if there is like three, a general practice doctors there and you go there, and then if you might be doing good service, but then maybe they'll be out of a job because you're there. So, there are things that we need to think through. But despite the caution, I guess what I'd like to do as we open it up for discussion is I'd like to invite you to share in this privilege, because we need to do it cautiously. So I'm not saying we should all rush in there, but cautiously, I would invite you to consider devoting your time toward global health. And here's an article in the New Yorker magazine. And it's actually talking about an ancient plague that probably most of us don't know much about. It was the plague of Cyprian in 251 AD. And the author writes that Christianity grew as a religion in part because so many followers of Jesus, because so many people saw followers of Jesus ministering to the sick and endangering their own lives to be with the dying. Those Christians were providing medical care and companionship, not insisting on their rights to carry on with life as usual. So my encouragement to you and my hope and prayer for you all is that you will not insist on your own rights, but perhaps choose to care for those who are sick and so that they can see you as a follower of Jesus Christ. Okay. So I deliberately made it a little shorter because usually my talks go right to the next minute, because I wanted to share with all the people who are here. There are many people who have longer experiences, more substantial experiences than I have, and I can see many of you in the room already. So I'd like to open it up to some questions and comments. Yes.
Question, but a small story. Mm-hmm. I have a loved one who's from Kenya, and her little sister is in her 30s, and she passed away 2 years ago from a post-op complication, ended up getting COVID after a surgery. Mm-hmm. Should have been routine. And I don't know anything about the state of medical education in Kenya, but to hear of this was really encouraging to me. So.
Yeah, thank you for that, yeah. Yes. Dr. Crouch, yeah?
How widespread is the concept of the clinical officers like in Africa? Is that other?
Yeah, so I'm sure others can weigh in, but to my knowledge, it's a fairly common system, at least in East Africa. There are a lot of clinical officers, and like I said, there's an overabundance of them, and many of whom are looking for some further training and greater opportunity. Yeah.
How about China, India?
I don't know. I don't know about the parts yet.
I don't have an answer to that. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Does anybody have any insights about clinical officers in other parts of the world besides Africa?
India has them,
okay.
Yeah, they have the junior doctors is what they call them there, but people okay. that have graduated from med school haven't done a residency working in a hospital.
Okay. Yeah, so that's a slightly different. So that's called medical officers, at least in Kenya and probably in other parts. So until very recently in Kenya, there really wasn't much of a residency system. So you went to medical school and you did the very, very traditional one-year internship, 3 months in medicine, 3 months in peds, 3 months in OB, 3 months in surgery. And then you went and did, like gallbladder operations and you treated sepsis and everything else. So that used to be basically any doctor in Kenya was like that. But probably in the last 30 years now, there's more and more residency training programs in there. So they call them consultants if you have trained in residency, medical officers if you have not. But they all went to medical school. The clinical officers are different in that they did not go to medical school. They did not go to nursing school. They're closer to physician assistants in the U.S. So it's a little bit different than what you're saying. Yes?
Have you considered having people from outside Kenya come to the clinical officer?
Yes. Actually, that has already started to happen. When we first started, everybody was based at Kajabi. But for example, Tenwick, realized what was happening, and so they sent people from, and Tenwick is about 3 hours away, so it's still Kenya. But they sent their crew of clinical officers to train at Kajabi. And now we are actually starting to get people from like Malawi and other countries, yeah. It's still predominantly Kenyan at the moment, but I think there is starting to do that. Yes. Yes.
I have a question about like in a low resource setting, kind of the disproportionate amount of resources that go to critical care patients. Like we see that in my institution, and, you know, everywhere in the U.S.
Yeah.
Like the amount that we spend on end of life care and all that. How do you go about balancing that in a low resource setting?
Yeah.
Like, say to save this one critically ill patient, you might use antibiotics, pressors, whatever, they can go to, you know, saving multiple lives.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question, and you know, it's one that I think, you know, brings a lot of moral distress to a lot of us who work there. So I don't have an easy answer because that's a very difficult question, but I think to a different degree, the same thing happens in the U.S., right? I mean, the one thing I would say is for example, you know, in my experience, what I learned is that a lot of what we do in the U.S. doesn't have to be done in Kenya without any real patient harm. So it doesn't have to be as expensive as the way we do it here. So one big example to me is, you know, in the U.S., anybody you start on vasopressors in the ICU, they get a central line. You know, I think things are starting to change now, but at least by tradition, central line for any kind of vasopressor. In Kenya, you know, as I'm sure everybody knows, the cost of one of those catheters is still about $50. But the average person makes $5 a day, so it's a tremendous financial burden. And it does sometimes mean that if you did that, maybe that kid will survive, maybe, okay? But then somebody else is not going to go to school now because the family spent the money on that. So because of those things, you know, we had to very carefully weigh the cost versus benefit. And then we didn't put in central lines. So I think in my 6 years that I was there, I put in roughly 2 central lines per year. And almost everybody else, you know, we treated without a central line. And you know what? They all did great. I mean, some who died, you know, obviously, but it wasn't because of the central line, is what I should say, yeah. Yeah. Tina, yeah.
And Bert, I think you did make the important point that a lot of critical care doesn't have to be that expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, to fluid resuscitate a kid who's in shock because of vomiting, diarrhea, dehydration doesn't cost that much.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can, or the kid who's got a hemoglobin of 2 from malaria and rapidly recognizing that and transfusing that kid doesn't have to be.
That's absolutely right,
So there's a lot of critical care that can be done in low resource settings just by paying attention.
That's right. Yeah, and actually to piggyback on that great point is that, you know, what we emphasize is not ICU care necessarily. It's actually treating critically ill people appropriately, you know, wherever they are. Even if you don't have ventilators, you don't have an ICU, there's still critically ill people who are coming in all the time. And there are low resource things or relatively inexpensive things that can be done. You know, like some of it is just recognition that they're sick, you know, so. I think you were next, yeah?
Yeah. Vern, did you start grappling with the nursing care aspects? Because I've had a lot of experience in Malawi and DRC. And, for example, one of my clinical officers' wife gave birth to quite premature twins. And he stayed in the hospital basically for 3 weeks to keep them alive. They survived. They did very well. But his comment on leaving the hospital was, you know, there's no way the nursing staff would ever have been able to carry out the orders you wrote to take care of this kid.
Yeah.
So that part of it is equally critical.
Yeah.
You know, the critical care provider goes out, and the nursing staff and the rest of the hospital support staff still has to do these things.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you, and actually on that point, you know, every once in a while somebody from some other part of Africa will say, hey, can you give us advice on starting an ICU in their country or their hospital? And actually, my response is almost always, actually, don't start an ICU, don't buy any machine, no ventilators, okay, but start training nurses. because they are the real care is provided in the ICUs by nurses, not so much by the doctors. And so the nurses are absolutely the core of what ICU care really is. So yeah, so I totally agree that it's not an easy problem to address, because at Kajabi, for example, we were about an hour and a half roughly outside of Nairobi. So plenty of people from Nairobi would come both as patients but also as nurses to train. And you know, and I think we did have a very good training program for nurses at Kajabi. So a lot of people would come, they'd get educated, they'd get experience, and after a year, then they would leave to go to Nairobi because their salaries in Nairobi were multiple times higher than what a mission hospital was able to pay. So we lost a lot of nurses. But we would provide training. So in some ways, it's good because now they're going to hopefully provide good care elsewhere. But we had a very difficult time maintaining nurses, and there were lots of politics and financial issues associated with that. So again, that's not a problem that's, I think, easily solved by one idea or one decree, but it is a major one, yeah. So nurses have to be a high, high priority. Yes, I think you were... Yeah.
I was just going to make something up the previous comment, that I was in West Africa working in the ER. I experienced a couple situations where the providers there were essentially PAs, kind of under-trained PAs, clinical officers more or less, had essentially killed a couple of people in the ER by over-fluid resuscitating people who were in heart failure. So just to make the point that not all care is doing something, sometimes the care is not doing something, and it's really encouraging to hear about these training programs, because I think it's just applicable anywhere that's got people at that level of training that really just bumping them up to the next level of being able to handle these more critical emergency patients, recognize what's really going on physiologically. Has the potential to save people with very, very little cost or no cost even.
Yeah.
So it's not even about spending money.
That's right.
It's about not spending money.
That's right, yeah. Thank you for that. I think you are next, I think, yeah.
So as far as creating a, for the African providers to have the time for research and having the faculty liaisons and fellows and stuff come over, what did that take? Was there buy-in essentially from the host institutes, the American institutes that allow the physicians to take that time?
Number one, in terms of host institution, which would be Kajabi in this case, yeah. So there's full buy-in from the CEO of the hospital, the medical director of the hospital, the head of internal medicine, et cetera. So they're part of the decision-making process, and they ultimately approve who can come and not. As far as the American institutions as well as the one Kenyan institutions, yes. So each of the liaisons have went to our bosses and the respective authorities and have complete buy-in that this is what we'll be doing. The faculty will be going, the fellows will be going, and that's really the conditions of joining this this collaboration. Now how that's done is variable. Some institutions say you can do it. Basically, good luck. Others say you can do it. We'll give you time. Others say we'll give you time and money. So there is a spectrum of the approaches that the eight institutions have. I think over there, yeah. Yeah, there are several of us who started the program together, and I think you saw the picture in the very front with the people there. But I think all of us agreed that we need to work ourselves out of a job essentially. So I think that was really built into the initial start. But we also had, I should have mentioned that we should have also had. I mean, we already had some models of success in similar programs at Kajabi. So probably the most important one, there's been several programs there, but the most important one is probably the partnership with Vanderbilt University, which actually Dr. Tarpley is part of. But Vanderbilt has sent anesthesia residents and attendings, and also surgical attendings on a regular basis. So Kajabi has had, I think, probably 20 plus years of that kind of partnership. And so we're able to learn from, you know, people like Mark Hutton, who's one of the anesthesiologists there, to learn about, you know, what worked, what didn't. So we had a lot of things to lean on when we were starting the program. Yeah. Yes.
Outside of the clinical officers you train, who provides the critical care? Are there critical care physician fellowship training programs in Kenya or in sub-Saharan Africa in general?
There's very, very few, I think Aga Khan, I think, just started one, I believe, but it's very, very few. The only one that I know of was the one in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, and that's also starting with a different group altogether. It's a secular university affiliations with folks in the U.S., there's a tremendous opportunity for that area. I think there was something way over there. I think I was ignoring. Tammy, thank you. Yeah. Okay. So how about way back there?
Yeah. Has anybody looked at the community impact of going from not having ICU care to having ICU care, and the medicalization or expectations of medicalization of the surrounding community because of an ICU or critical care being?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a very important question. I guess the short answer is no, but that's something that should be looked at. I can tell you that even with us starting the ECHO program, actually Kenya government had already decided they're going to build ICUs. But I wasn't sure how they're going to staff the ICUs because there is no, you know, intensivists and so forth. So I think the wider impact and whether there are unintended consequences, like maybe now everyone's going to get ICU when it's not appropriate and things like that, I think those are legitimate concerns. So I think those are that's a great point. But we have not studied that, but someone should. Yes.
I'm curious, what did y'all use to help develop your global health curriculum the critical care curriculum on the drive? Was it you guys met and decided on a group of articles, or?
Yeah, so that's almost a separate topic to discuss how you come up with a curriculum like that. But number one, I was a fellowship program director in the U.S. prior to me going to Kenya, so I had some experience in doing all of those things. But I think what the education literature says is that if you assign somebody a textbook chapter versus a review article versus a summary point that is as brief as possible, the one that gets read the most is a summary. And so we use educational philosophies like that to increase the likelihood that you'll actually get utilized. And so what's on Google Drive is not like some chapter of Harrison's or even up-to-date kind of stuff, but it was actually stuff that we wrote ourselves, you know, and it's usually like a 4 or 5 page summary of a big topic rather than, you know, 30 pages and things like that. And then that also allows you to tailor it to the local environment. So if a book chapter talks about, you know, things that they don't have there, that's kind of not very helpful, right? But you can say, well, use dopamine because that's what's available or something like that, yeah? So it allows you to tailor it. And then the other is, you know, I think we all know that when you teach, usually people are polite, so they nod their heads, and it seems like they're paying attention, like you seem to be. But the truth is, probably some of you are thinking about something else, you know, and that kind of stuff. So we do intentionally make it very, very interactive. And so most of our quote-unquote lectures are actually problems for them to solve after they do the reading. So we don't usually, you know, stand up and just, you know, lecture on, but, you know, they're supposed to do the reading. And then they come and says, now let's solve this problem together. So after a while they realize they can't really come unprepared. So, and, And actually, we were worried about that model because we know that there's a cultural differences and, you know, whether that would really work or not. But actually, they loved it. I mean, you know, actually, after a while, you can't get them to shut up because they're just so, you know, yeah, into it. Yeah. Yes?
Have you come across resistance to change, mm-hmm. particularly when it comes to changing a culture's or a system's methodology mm-hmm. in terms of medicine? Mm-hmm. All your students are going out to their home villages or mm-hmm. neighboring villages and say, hey, I found a new way to do this. Mm-hmm. Have you come up to resistance to change, to changing it? I can't tell you how many yeah. times in rural sub-Saharan hospitals mm-hmm. I've been told, this is just how we do things.
Yeah.
This,
yeah.
this is how we do things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's another great point. I mean, you know, nobody likes change, you know, and I think it's true for us as well. So I think, it, I mean, honestly, it goes both ways because, you know, when you go as a missionary, you know, I think the tendency or the default is that you're the expert, you know, because you are trained in the U.S. and all that stuff. And actually, a lot of times we realize we have to change. And, you know, and certainly that was the case for me. There were plenty of mistakes I made and, you know, people I've offended inadvertently. So I'll definitely admit that. But the other side is true, too, is that, you know, obviously everybody has an ego. Everybody wants to think that they're doing the right thing. And then sometimes it's not that they resist the idea, but they resist the way the idea is being presented or how it makes them feel, right? So it's not so much that the idea is wrong or they think is wrong. It's just that it makes them look bad or something like that. So it's a lot more delicate than just, you know, giving them a New England Journal article and saying, this is why we're doing this, right? It's all about the chai, in my opinion, in Kenya. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, you know, actually, continuing education in Kenya is not as maybe as rich as the opportunities here, but they exist. So two comments about that. One is that picture I think you saw with all those clinical officers, that's their annual conference. It happens typically in September. It's a continuing education program for them. So there is something. The other thing about continuing education in Africa, if you didn't know, is that, as you know, I think it's still true today, but when I was there, there is no continuing education in Kenya without pharmaceutical company support. It's actually quite bad. So I worry about the integrity and the quality of continuing education. So. Yes? Yeah, we don't have a booth, but we are now a nonprofit group. So we're actually working on a website that should be up like any week now, maybe next week or something like that. So you can look us up in maybe in a month or so, and we should have something up. We don't have a booth, but I did mention that we're doing this in phases. So we're currently in phase two. Phase three would be to take this model to other institutions. So we already have requests from some other sub-Saharan African countries and one in Brazil. So I'm not sure which one we will expand to, if at all, but we're going to try to, you know, see when that is feasible and whether it's advisable, I guess. And then phase four would be to invite other institutions. So we actually already have 16 other institutions that want to join us in this. I should know because we spent an hour discussing the domain name, but it's something like Global Critical Care Collaborations, but I think some version of it was taken, so, but yeah. Sorry, I don't remember. Yes.
I know you mentioned that there's also the pediatric mm-hmm. training now, so yeah. is that a part of this whole thing? Is that kind of encompass both the dual and the
Well, so it's a separate program, yeah. So it's a separate training process, and they it's actually, I believe it's in partnership also with University of Washington that has a pediatric critical care program for physicians in Kenya now.
There's a collaborative between Kajabi, actually, mm-hmm. and Kenyatta to do pediatric critical care and emergency room.
Okay, yeah. Great, yeah. Okay, I think we're almost out of time. Any last minute? Yes. Well, I mean, I think there are there are potentially many different opportunities, but I guess it depends on if you're talking about critical care things, you know, then, I mean, right now, at GC3, we decided that we're going to limit it to our institutions because we want to vet the people who go, and you don't have to be a believer, by the way. You know, we're taking people from U.S. secular institutions, but we still want to vet the people to make sure that it'll be a good fit for Kajabi. So we don't have immediate opportunities at the moment, but maybe in a year or two things will change. If you talk about education in general, or even critical care education for that matter, you know, I think you know there are things like MEI, for example, that CMDA sponsors. But I think there's no shortage of opportunities if you want to look at those. Okay, so I think it's 9 o'clock, so I will close it. And thank you so much, and I'll be happy to entertain questions up front.